Borini, Real 10. You moved on from Hong Kong. Did you go to Japan or did you go straight to South Korea? What were your first impressions of Busan and South Korea?
Well, first of all, it was a wreck. It was raining, if I remember right. It was September. We had an American Negro band, most of the Negro band, apparently, they were all Negro, apart from the chaplains in the blue, which is why welcomed us on the quayside with various tunes, one of which was about how we were coming out of Hayden Cake. And they were marching up and down, working to a whistle. Then we disembarked, got on the train, and then went up.
And what was the train like?
Primitive. I can't remember what the rationing arrangements were. I think they were given 24-hour packs. And I can't remember how long they took it up for.
A long, slow journey. It wasn't a quick journey.
I think it took several days. But when we were there on the river, it took 4 hours, I think it was. But then it was a bullet train, and it was very good, very comfortable, and very fast. Quite honestly, I didn't take very much notice of what the countryside was like. It looked as though it was pretty damaged and poor. And wet. It's quite surprising, actually. I really, it's a blank. The journey from Busan to Seoul is a blank. I can't remember anything about the call, anything about it at all. And when we got to Seoul, we were taken to the Britannia camp, where we were based, prior to going into the line.
And what was it like?
Well, it was a tented place. Okay, primitive. I mean, the toilets was a tent with a hole and a sort of piece of log. And you sat on the log and got pretty full actually. So you had to keep on moving the thing. But we were sat up while we were there. Food was all right because it was made American rations. It was very rich food.
Now what kind were you getting? I mean, the Americans tended to be this way.
Masses of turkey, ham. We didn't get all that much beef, actually. But mostly turkey. But, you know, my recollection of the food is turkey, frankly, all the year round. And ham. Not just turkey on Thanksgiving Day, but it was turkey all the time. And also, we ate a lot of... these 24-hour, American 24-hour packs, which were very, very rich as well. You know, they were sickly almost, so rich. Mess life was all right. It was quite a reasonably comfortable mess. We lived in tents. We had camp beds, I had a tent myself. I think some of the soldiers shared tents, two to a tent. And we were just being briefed by various people who were cared for life, which was that we were leaving. They came and talked to us about the countryside and the war and our relations with the Americans and various things like that. We had a visit from a chap called Ricketts, Andy Ricketts, who was an ex-DLI. He was in the final lecture. He actually finished up after Richards, he finished up in Cyprus as a major general when I was there. But anyway, he came and saw us, welcomed us to the place.
The Americans come over to give you talks as well?
Yes. Canadians, Australians, yes.
And presumably quite a bit of this would be about the Chinese themselves, the people that you're going to be... facing, you know, no, the people you are facing, that we're telling you about the Chinese soldier, whatever.
Yes, we weren't facing the North Koreans. They were all German. In my experience there, we only had Chinese opposition. Yeah. I don't think we ever had a Korean unit, North Korean unit.
And how long were you in this camp before you moved?
We were there for about 3 weeks.
And this was all, presumably, getting yourself sorted out and ready for to move. Did you do any training there?
Not really. There were chutes, but it was most of Turkey get climatized in Turkey, so it was fit. We didn't have to do much in the way of training. It was getting fit after the journey, getting out land feet, land legs, and that sort of thing. There were recces up to the part of the land that we were going to do. I went on two of those, probably for the mortars. That first experience I had of they were using a broker's gun as a artillery piece. With a flat trajectory, you know, you have to be higher up than anything else in front of you, because otherwise you'd be knocking out of the reserve people. And it was a terrible crack. I think that's where my nearly first time to go.
What was the terrain like that you were going to move into?
Hilly. Very hilly.
And the positions you occupy, where would they be?
Where would they be?
Oh, the tops of hills or wherever,
For the forward troops, and reserve, well, not necessarily reserve. Mine was the two, was behind the hill, the bottom of it. It was like a knob of the hill, and then there was a valley, and then there was another line of hills, which had the two forward companies, and then the reserve companies were just behind me. The town headquarters was a little bit further. There was a place called Nae Chon. I think the height, most of the places were either given a name or a height. I think the height of that one was 153, I think.
And where were the Chinese in relation to the battalion positions?
They were in front.
Across the valley?
Across a valley, yes. And the valley actually was occupied by what we called Nature.
The positions that you moved into, what were they like? You know, the actual digging of them, and what were they?
Were they
First World War trenches, or were they slit trenches, or what? We know.
They were already dug for a start, and because we were taking over a static position in a static war, there's no mobility at all. So what we spent most of our time doing was improving them, revetting them, where they collapsed because of shell fire and repairing them. And largely petroleum. That was the main activity. And most of it, of course, was night. So by day, it was largely the sentries.
So the activity was at night, and daytime was pretty quiet.
Yeah.
When you first moved up to the line, you said your particular position was at the foot of the hill. Can you tell me how that was built and how it was constituted? What the position was like?
Right, so the mortars were in pits, round pits, which with a couple of mortars probably sticking out about that much.
About a couple of foot. Hmm? About a couple of foot, 18 about inches, a couple of foot.
Yes, and enough space round about for ammunition and for the three. You'd have the air of course, probably up the cliff, up the hillside.
And it's just, so you had a post somewhere ahead of you, which was your aiming, as you say, your aiming post.
That would have been put out on a compass bearing.
How far forward would that be, you'd think?
Well, as far as the better, but it couldn't put too far in front of the hill going up, so it would be about 20 yards at most.
And all of your aiming and moving of the weapons would be based on that point.
Then there would be what they call the hoochies. There would be tape, which would be guiding you at night, necessarily at night, either steps or footpaths going up to where the hoochies were, most of which were actually on the hillside in front of the mortars.
And what was a hoochie?
A hoochie was a dugout which had been reinforced and built, covered by, at that time, by sandbags. So you'd dig into the cliff of
hillside like that, you dig in like that. So, and then you would then rebet with the sandbags on either side, and then put some planks or something in the tin, and then put sandbags over the top of that, and then cover it over with earth. Wasn't really necessary to cover it over with earth because there was no need for any overhead camouflage, because they hadn't any aircraft of any particular ones that were using very much. So we were never terribly bothered by it, unless we were being overlooked by the Chinese, in which case we needed to do a little bit of overhead camouflage.
And these were the sleeping quarters for the for your particular platoon.
I had a routine myself, and it was also in that routine was the command post, wireless and that order, which again was a static, it would be a big wireless, which would be communicating with the battalion headquarters as well as the companies and the OPs, and then usually the mortal men would stick and loop you together so that they would be very compliant with whatever they come out and do this stuff.
What was the distance from your weapon pits to your hoochies?
About anything between 10 and 15, about 30 yards. About that position. I don't think I've worked for it now, but yes.
So you've got your positions, Dirk. How many weapons? How many?
Six mortars.
So what kind of distance were there between each mortar when you'd set your position up?
And the forward companies.
Oh, see, sorry. Yes, I'm trying to get.
We're behind the hills.
Yes.
There's another valley, and then our forward companies, and then there's another valley, and then
we would have been
probably about 1,000 yards short of our own forward people, and they would be another 400 or 500 yards short of the Chinese, probably quite a wide valley. So the average range would be somewhere between 1,500 to 2,000 yards, depending on how what we were looking at finding the shell.
And how did you dispose your six mortars? How were they disposed?
Well, it was usually in a line, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and that. And then the position would come would be sort of around it, made one position would be the hitches and the cookout together, which would usually be either the mortars.
And you'd be covering the two, whatever, the forward companies?
We would, and over in the
battalion front.
Such as it was, that's what disappointed me with it. I always found that generally you could control them more very easily. If you weren't too late, and you could then quite confidently call for mortar fire, which was the most accurate type of fire. That was like laying on after each bomb had been fired. You collected the air because of the thing that was called. If you have to put that on the modifier, then you would expect a bit of dispersion. But with modifier, you used to get very good accuracy. It's not meant to be a terribly accurate weapon, but at least you'd get the bombs falling in a decent area. But there, I don't know what was happening. I mean, I would personally range the whole six mortars. And then Peter would say, right, have a go at that over there. And they'd be all over the place. The only successful exercise, we were only there 10 days, first time, and Peter said, I want you to put a smoke screen in front of your hill. And I said, yeah, okay. Right. Now that meant we had to take the tripod in and hold it because it was so short, just over the hill, and use the four secondaries. To get the height in order to enable the bombs to the timing to work for. And it did work, actually. It's so thick you told them to stop it because if the Chinese want to do anything, they get rid of it. We only fired about 50 bombs per mortar. And it worked like a charm.
It was
really thick in the valley, but I was on top of that watching it.
It must take a certain amount of strength to hold a 3-inch mortar and aim it, you know, off its tripod. Do you wear gloves for that kind of thing? What about the noise that a mortar makes? Is this?
Well, it's what you're supposed to do. It's when you put the bomb down, you're supposed to you put the bomb down and carry on with your head so that your head is below the level of the muzzle. That's the theory. But I mean, most times you see it on warfields, they're just running on that like that. You know, and that's I think probably started this off because I didn't do that. I was firing on that occasion. And I just run the thing down to the road, crack, you know, and I started ringing in the ear, and I went sick after the line. And then he said, you know, you probably can't hear the bang, so. Yes, the principle was to get your head below the muscle band with some protection. Whenever you put, now I think they have implants, or things over the ears, yeah.
The crew of each mortar, I think there was an aimer, a chap who aimed the mortar,
yes.
And the one that dropped the shell in, was he the fire or something? What title did he have?
There was a chap who did the aiming, and quite right. He corrected the aim each time. And then you had the chap who actually put the bomb down the barrel. And then the third chap was getting the stuff, the weapons, the ammunition ready to handle the fire. That was it.
And
the essential thing was, if you were doing smoke, was to get as much ready before you started, and get as ready as you could. The sort of basic calculation of 10% of the way didn't always work out, as was the case in Korea. You know, so therefore, it would probably be necessary to adjust the timing in order to get the best out of the smoke bomb canister. So that chap had to be ready, the third chap, number three, had to be ready to do this.
Who was bringing the ammunition up as you used it? As it was all stacked there. Bit dangerous if something landed there, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I know that way. That's probably dead running up and down. No, it was stacked there.
And you said you fired smoke and high explosive. What was the range of a 3-inch mortar?
2,800 charges. Charge one. They had four. The bombs had four secondary charges in the fin, in between the fins, and charge two had all four, and charge one they took two out. On opposite sides, and threw away or disposed of them somewhere, and I would just put them aside. I think I told you that those charges were the ones that caught fire when I was in Malaya in the carrier. It was those charges that found themselves into the carrier and got near the exhaust and caught fire. That was what the inquiry said. But so you had to be careful with this. You had the odd. Not misfired, but dead, you know, it didn't work at all. You would often get prematures, pre-ignitions. If you'd be firing a lot and barrels were hot, the secondary charges would catch fire on the way down, which meant that they didn't have the full propeller when they went up, and they could be dangerous. Very often, if they just close flopped over the edge of the barrel, they hadn't got enough impact to arm the bomb prior to leaving the barrel, so it didn't go off. But I remember one occasion in Malaya, we had five of these, and all five of them went off. You know, and they just landed about 20 yards or 25 yards in front of the position, and two of them went off the earth and took off the plane. But we didn't have that experience at all in Korea. Personally, I didn't personally. During the 10 days that I was bought across, the 10 days in the land.
So it's quite a skilled job, though, being a mortarman.
Right, it needs training, yes. I wouldn't call it a skilled job. The most skilled of the three, but it had to be the paymaster, the mayor on the board. And he had to do his job very carefully. Usually it would be one or three of them, one or three, one or three of them would be allowed for me. And about another one, he would be allowed out of that because you were allowing him to be active on the film. There was usually a corporal or a sergeant keeping an eye on the people who were doing the firing, and then you'd have the OP group out the front, which could be either me or two, no, it would be either me and the two sides of the back or the two sides of the back.
And you'd have radio contact, did you? Was it a good set?
Yes, it didn't have much problem with communication. The only problem really was that I found later on that I got out of control of the noise.
What was the firing rate of a mortar? How fast could you set your bombs away? So you'd have several in the air at the same time.
You were firing for 2,800, you could have as many as five or six in the air at one time. You had a really good look. And the first chap having them up, having them ready, having them up once.
And presumably you would have firing such as on a given target, and then the bombardment type of exercise there.
Well, to be quite honest with you, I never did that. And I can't recall that they even come out to another from me. I can't recall that they were required to do that. I don't know, I mean, I think Peter was somebody anyway, was a bit wary of them because they were so inaccurate. And I wasn't very happy with that. The only time that I put down any form of concentrated mortar fire was mortar fire, which meant laying each round. And that, I mean, it was so scattered that it was ineffective.
Did it fire shrapnel as well as high explosives?
No. The high explosives was shrapnel.
Oh, right.
But it wasn't like the bits and pieces,
You've talked about the inaccuracy there. Do you think it was the climate that caused the inaccuracies?
I don't know what it was. It might have been the thin air, or it might have been so high up. I don't know what the cause of it. I just do not know.
You've mentioned the fact that your own men some of them were caught when there was a misfire. Were there any other accidents amongst the forward troops through our own mortar fire?
Not while I was. In fact, I don't know of any. I did have an unfortunate experience in Germany with them, but that was largely unfortunately we were firing smoke, I given a correction, and one of the mortars misheard the correction, or he put instead of going left, he gone right, and he put three shells right in the middle of the company that was advancing. Well, the immediate action then is to shout stop, everything holds stop immediately.
In the 10 days that you were with them, do you have any memories of that particular period? What was happening to you?
That was the one exercise that I really felt, proved it more good. I learned a bit there, mainly from sort of interior economy. When we took over from the Aussies, any sort of duds or misfires that the Aussies had, we used to chuck them into a pond, which was just the back of it. And there were shells with fins sticking up, and all that sort of thing. And I started doing that, but I thought, well, that's a bit silly, this, So we didn't do that. We got the pioneer chap to come up and blow them up. But I didn't bother with any of the others down there. And the other thing I didn't do, which I should have done, I suppose, was tidy the place up. I don't know why, I mean, what usually after that, we usually run into the thing. Firstly, the room is tidy up and make sure that the steps were firm and the booties were well constructed. We did that, but it was a matter of bullshit, really, you know, getting it almost like the whitewashing thing. Just to keep the place looking tidy from the point of view of morale. And also from the point of view of safety. And thereafter, you know, I was always very conscious of that sort of state in the positions that we were in.
And after 10 days you moved. Was that voluntary or
ten
what?
Days, no, 10 days. We just relieved and then we'd done our first 10-day spell, experience, combat experience. And we went back to the area of Biashmore, where we were in reserve, or brigade reserve, for I think about 2 weeks. And that we do a training there, we were doing patrolling and that sort of thing. But in that time, when we were in the line the first 10 days, Sean Kelly got very badly wounded. He was pretty shot and went up his rear end. Which meant the general sort of shuffled round. Bob Scott, I think, took that company over. And I was taken out next season. And I went to IC to back on again.
Which company was this? Which company?
A company.
Had there been a great deal of activity in that first 10 weeks?
Not really. It was mainly patrolling, getting used to the patrolling, getting used to the terrain, getting used to what things are like at night, you know, how things change at night. Just becoming sort of battle prepared, battle practiced. You know? There had been some shelling, and it was that particular shelling which. And of course, it served its purpose later on. Of course, we went back into that position, and we were familiar with it, and that was where we did our raid.
And this initial period, I mean, you may not know, but this initial action or activity, they'd stood up pretty well to it, these national servicemen. There hadn't been any.
Yes, very good.
They'd come through their first blooding quite well.
Yeah, they were there. What was more, they were extremely cheerful. I was very pleased with them, very proud of them.